I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Have you ever seen a Rothko? Ever stood in a museum and looked deeply into the floating rectangles of blue dissolving into black, of red bleeding into orange? Some people find such works of art enthralling. Others find them baffling and look around for an explanation. Those paintings made Mark Rothko one of the most famous American artists of the 20th century. They also made him rich. But Rothko had a love-hate relationship with his success as an abstract expressionist. Deeply conflicted and troubled, he committed suicide in 1970, leaving behind hundreds of paintings worth millions. French scholar and cultural historian Annie Cohen-Salal tells us what she learned about Mark Rothko as she researched her new book about him on Midday after the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Just before the news from NPR, I asked if any of you in our audience today had ever seen a Rothko, that is, a painting by the famous abstract expressionist Mark Rothko. For those who are familiar with Rothko, what comes to mind? I'll bet you see floating squares of blue dissolving into black, rectangles of red, orange, and pink. Perhaps you've seen Rothko's Black Over Red at the Baltimore Museum of Art. Some people find such works of art enthralling. Some have been known to have very strong emotional reactions to Rothko paintings. Others find them strange and look around for an explanation. Some people become self-conscious that there's something going on that they just don't get. A Rothko showed up a few years ago in the acclaimed television drama Mad Men. One of the partners of the Sterling Cooper advertising agency in Mad Men was rumored to have paid an outrageous sum for an abstract painting for his office. So four of the agency employees decided to sneak into the office to see what the fuss was about. Now, we're going to listen to that scene as a secretary, a nervous and baffled advertising executive, an art director, and a writer all enter the office. The art director recognizes the orange-amber Rothko immediately, but he and the others are all a bit dumbfounded at first and have different reactions to the painting they find on the boss's wall.
Just don't touch anything.
It's a Rothko. Why the hell didn't Dale say that?
$10,000.
So it's smudgy squares, huh? That's interesting.
Two possibilities. Either Cooper loves it, and you have to love it, like in an Emperor's New Clothes situation, or he thinks it's a joke, and you'll look like a fool if you pretend to dig it.
People like him pretend they understand this.
Maybe he has a brochure in here or something that explains it.
I don't think it's supposed to be explained.
I'm an artist, okay? It must mean something.
Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're just supposed to experience it. Because when you look at it, you do feel something, right? It's like looking into something very deep. You could fall in.
That's true. Did someone tell you that?
How could someone tell you that?
This is pointless. Let's go.
It's interesting that one of the characters in that scene wants to search the office for a brochure that explains the painting. Interesting and amusing because many people believe that a Rothko is not meant to be explained, just as that character said in that scene, but experienced or felt. Our guest in this hour of Midday took on the challenge of explaining Rothko, or at least giving us a better understanding of his life, from his origins in Tsarist Russia in 1903 to his life's tragic end in 1970 in New York City. Today we have the pleasure of conversation with a French scholar, cultural historian, professor and writer who is visiting Baltimore again, Annie Cohen-Salal. Annie Cohen-Salal is the acclaimed biographer of philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. She later served as cultural counselor to the French embassy in the United States and was a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins University. In addition to her best-selling book on Sartre, she has published a book about American painters called Painting American and another on the famous art dealer Leo Castelli called Leo and His Circle. Annie Cohen-Salal is visiting the U.S. again, occasioned by the publication of her book on Mark Rothko. It's called Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. It's published by Yale University Press, part of its Jewish Lives series. Ani Cohen-Salal, nice to have you on the show today. Thanks for being with us.
Dan, I must say something before we start. I must say that I am amazed by you. Can we say a secret to the audience? Can I tell them I met you on Twitter?
Yeah, we met on Twitter a few months ago. Yeah. And then I started reading about you. And I remember when the Castelli book came out some years ago, but I never got to interview you before that.
So the thing is, I noticed from Paris how early you wake up.
Yes.
Because when you send first tweet, it's 4 a.m. or something, right?
Yes, sometimes that's true. Well, I rise very early to prepare for this show and for my newspaper work. So.
And what is amazing about you is that you cover as well the local news.
Yeah.
As well as the world news. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'm so excited to be with you and to be challenged by you about Rothko. I think that this little clip,
yes,
of Mad Men is a total surprise and absolutely brilliant.
Well, I picked that up because someone else had noticed this in the press, in the art press, and I thought, mm-hmm, gee, this is a good way to get started in the show, because those four people in that scene all have reactions that any of us have had to a Rothko or abstract art of any kind. Especially a Rothko. So I was wondering, as you were listening to that, does that sound familiar to you? Have you been with people who for the first time are seeing a Rothko in person in a museum and either are confused or are pulled into it?
Yes, absolutely. It is very true, and it's very specific reactions to Rothko. One curator wrote that Rothko's paintings are mirror to our emotions. And what is very interesting is this question of he needs an explanation. I think art does not need an explanation. My book is not made for that. My book is putting Mark Rothko's work in context. Because Mark Rothko is a painter, but not only a painter. He's also an intellectual, an educator, and a pioneer. And what I have been able to access are new documents, and what I have been able to offer to my readers is putting Mark Rothko in touch with new issues of today, 2015 issues. Mark Rothko is a complete pioneer. He's a complete contemporary. Although he died in 1970, as you said, he committed suicide on the 25th of February. Then his art is reaching every single day more and more audiences, more and more publics, and higher prices. For example, in a month from now, I hope you're going to tweet me, to still tweet me after this together.
Oh, I will.
I'll be in Korea, my dear. I'll be in Korea following the collection that Harry Cooper is taking care of at the National Gallery of Art in D.C., the Rothko collection, to Seoul, Korea, and the show will open. And I am so intrigued to see the reactions of Korean people, in front of those abstract art. And that's why I'm writing a blog. I'm writing a blog tracing Mark Rothko's echoes around the world. A month ago, I was in the Netherlands, where the curator there has put one work of Rothko in a single room. I mean, he did that for the latest works. So you sit in front of the art and you meditate. What Rothko demanded is that his art be seen peacefully, in silence, that the viewer be surrounded by his art, and that it would not be passing by, but it would be that there's a privilege that you sit down and you just are, interacting with the work, and those are floating rectangles. It's not figurative. I mean, what he's painted after 1950. He got to his trademark, to his floating rectangles. And, so you cannot really describe it, and it doesn't translate well in pictures or on the internet.
It doesn't. We have some, for our listeners who go to my Facebook page, we posted some examples.
You also have a Facebook page? watch.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, I have to get
so
to
do
that.
You, too, right?
No, yeah, but I don't use it. You have to teach me that.
There are some photographs of Rothko, of himself, the artist, and some examples of his art. And I just don't think the digital age, this works in the digital age. You have to actually go
why?
And sit.
You know why?
Yeah.
Because Rothko was, first of all, you know, he wanted the audience to, I mean, the public to get empowered by his works. He wanted, you know, the drive from his colors to give to the person who looks at it the feeling that he is as powerful as the artist. And Rothko, in the later stage of his life, invented a new technique, mixed up pigments, so much so that his painting would become almost fluorescent.
I wanted to ask you, if you turn the lights out in one of these rooms in a
they
museum,
glow.
Do they actually glow?
They do glow. They do glow, you know?
Let me ask you about this, because you were saying how Rothko paintings are meant to be experienced. People should sit in silence and meditate. That's what he wanted. He didn't want them to be interior decorations. Right?
He hated the word.
Yeah.
His paintings were decorative.
Right.
When critics would write that, he would be furious.
Okay. Well, he famously rejected an offer he originally took to create paintings for the new Four Seasons restaurant in New York City in the Seagram's building. Mm-hmm. Now, originally, he agreed to do a series of paintings for this restaurant for $35,000. And then why don't you tell our listeners, I know this is a famous story for those who followed the life of Rothko, but a lot of our listeners probably never heard this story.
Okay, so Rothko is famous. His paintings sell well. His gallery is Sidney Janney's gallery. And he gets a huge commission from the Bronfman family. They are building in 1954 this extravagant skyscraper on Park Avenue, with Mies van der Rohe and Philip Johnson as architects. Because they want to add a restaurant downstairs, the Four Seasons restaurant, they need panels inside the restaurant, and they go to Rothko, which is a great favor, a great privilege, a great honor. So first, Rothko agrees, and he gets himself a studio, which is the size of the room, huge. And for a whole year, he's going to work on these panels, three kinds of series, beautiful things. And then he takes off for the summer in Europe. This trip is extremely interesting because during the 3 months of the summer, there is a process of doubt which is going on in his head. First he goes to Naples, then he goes to Florence. He sees Fra Angelico in San Marco in Florence, and he notices how important it is to confront yourself with a fresco in a little cell. And he understands the power of the art on himself. Then he goes to England. He has a lot of followers in England, disciples even. And these people live in a colony in Cornwall. So he goes, talks to them, and then they show him a medieval church in ruin, and Rothko stares in front of it and says, but this is exactly where I would like to have my panels, and not in this Seagram building with all this money, and I don't want this
and people eating
rich
food.
Rich people eating food in front of my beautiful art.
Right.
So he comes back to New York and says, I'm sorry, I'm not doing that for you. It's a wrong match. I'm giving you back the money, I'm getting back panels, and goodbye. So the whole story, but then, this is 1959, and he commits suicide in 1970, but the last decade of his life, he's going to experiment, having had the idea of site-specific art, which is that the viewer is surrounded by the art, like in the Seagram building, in this restaurant. So he takes the idea from them and he develops it for himself. He's going to develop it in his 1961 show at MoMA. And he's going to invent what he calls a revolution in viewing. So he understands that in order to be really moved by a painting, the viewer has to be in a dark room, has to sit, has to be surrounded by the art. The art has to be low, has to be on an off-white wall so that the white of the wall doesn't compete with the colors. And he has to invent a new chemistry for his pigments.
But he knew that some of his paintings were going to be sold to very wealthy people who would use them as they wished in their homes, on large walls, maybe even as part of an interior decorator's idea. Correct? He knew that would happen.
Yes.
He became a wealthy man.
You know, Mark Rothko was very controlling. These were things that he could not control. But, you know, he controlled most of the things. What I can tell you, Dan, is that the best achievement in his project as an intellectual, because, you know, there's a political commitment to that, is that anybody is able to enjoy his works of art, not people, not only rich people. And what does it show is that the last experiment is a commission that he accepted from Dominique de Menil in Houston. She was exactly like him, an immigrant. And it's not an accident that they are two immigrants, two trajectories of immigrants, not exactly the same kind, because she was extremely wealthy and she was Protestant and Catholic. But these two immigrants managed to invent a new kind of institution in the United States, the Rothko Chapel, because Rothko fought the conventional American institutions. And this Rothko Chapel is free, is accessible to anyone. And you sit in the center of these extraordinary panels. This has become, since its creation, its inauguration, 1971, the most visited pilgrimage place in the U.S. by, you know, world leaders, you know, who believe in peace and, you know, nonviolent leaders. And this is an incredible achievement.
That's the Rothko Cathedral.
The Rothko Chapel.
Chapel, I'm sorry.
You and the Jewish channel who made the mistake.
I'm sorry.
It's a Rothko Chapel. Ecumenical.
I know.
Ecumenical.
It's the subtitle of...
should talk to your shrink about it.
Ani Cohen-Salal is our guest. This is in the subtitle of her book, Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. And more about the artist Mark Rothko when we get back with Ani Cohen-Salal. If you've had a Rothko experience... If you'd like to join us.
If you want to sell a Rothko.
Or if you want to sell a Rothko. I don't know. The 3 years ago at Christie's, one sold for $87 million.
Yes,
we're going to talk about the monetization of art and Mark Rothko when we get back. But if you've had a Rothko experience, meaning, you know, you went to a museum and you sat for a while and you looked at these colors and these shapes and... I would like to know what your experience was like, if you care to describe it for us. 410-662-8780, the toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, WYPR. Stay with us for the second hour of Midday, this afternoon at 1, where we take a look at the jobs picture in Maryland, at which skills are in most demand, and what sectors are looking to hire. Midday on Jobs, this afternoon at 1, here on WYPR. And coming our way later today...
Ask a group of teenagers in Havana what change they want most, and they don't ask for the moon.
Welcome back to Midday. In this hour with Ani Cohen-Salal, French scholar, cultural historian, biographer of Sartre, and now Mark Rothko. Her new book is Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. This book is published as part of the Jewish Lives series from Yale University Press. And I'm making a note here about Yale University because that figures into Mark Rothko's life story. And I want to come back to that in a minute. But first, Ani, let's go over just a little bit of the biography here. Born Markus Rothkevitz in Latvia in 1903, correct?
Yes. It was not Latvia, actually, if I may correct you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was the Russian Empire.
Oh, right, the Tsarist Empire.
This part of Russian Empire became Latvia in 1918.
Okay,
afterwards.
Thanks.
But it was the Pale of Settlement, where the Jews were confined to live at the time within the Russian Empire. And this little boy was the youngest of a family of four, much younger than his older siblings. And the father was a pharmacist, very secular, very well-read, very literary. and completely, you know, Bundist, like politically involved. Mm. Now, why did he put the small kid, Marcus, into a Talmud Torah school, which is a religious Jewish school and of the Orthodox kind, when the older siblings had not been in Jewish schools? Why? And I tried to, and that I think that left a mark on the kid. You know, for he stayed there for 7 years at least. At age 10, he immigrated to the United States. And I think I understand why, because the father was threatened that the two older boys, as used to be the case, were taken in as drafted into the Russian army as Jewish boys, and that would have lasted for 25 years. So in order to protect his youngest son, he put him in a religious school. In this case, he would not have been drafted. Then the father left to the US with the older boys, and the little boy came back with his mother, joining the family in New Haven, then in Portland, Oregon, Marcus Rodkovich. And when he traveled with mother and sister in 1913 throughout the country, 3 weeks train ride from New York to Portland, Oregon, he was dressed. He said to his friend Motherwell, the painter, "You cannot imagine what it is to be a Jewish boy dressed in black as a Russian kid, traveling the U.S. with a label on his neck which said, 'I don't speak English.'" Painful experience of the immigrant.
He did well in school.
He was terrific.
And managed to get to Yale University. Did not have a good experience at Yale University.
Yeah, it was a time where the immigration of Jews was very high. The numbers were very high. And the Jews were good scholars because education has always been a tradition in the Jewish tradition. And it was the case for him. So he was so proud of having achieved to get into Yale. The problem is that it was a mammoth class. It was a huge class. And this is what the dean of Yale College wrote to his president. "I think we shall have to change our view in regard to the Jewish element. A few years ago, every single scholarship of any value was won by a Jew. We must put a ban on the Jews." So being there at Yale, having achieved this extraordinary sanctuary, epitome of the academia that he wanted to integrate, and feel that basically the average student was interested in athletics, sports, and fraternities, and that he was not welcomed, was horrible for him. It was horrible. So he created a magazine called the Yale Saturday Evening Pest.
Pest, yeah,
where
right.
where he was wonderful. Yeah. Because he stood up, he stood up as a leader, he stood up as a writer, he stood up as a fighter, as a rebel, and he said these are false gods, you know, sports is a false god, let us think, let us doubt. And he really immediately, he appeared as someone who will not comply with those exclusions, you know. So his trajectory is that of an immigrant who stood up as a writer, as an intellectual, against the ethos of rejection, and who became an artist as the only way to find his own identity in American society.
How did he become an artist? What was his first... when was he first in touch with that talent?
He went... First of all, he was not the kind of guy who went to museums or was a good draftsman as a kid. He was most interested in philosophy or drama. But he went with a friend to the Art Students League one day, and he looked at a class doing you know, model drawing, and he said, "That's a life for me." He immediately, it was an epiphany, but I would say more than that, because I know you like paradoxes, Dan. It was both an epiphany and a necessity. Maybe it was the only way to find his own identity in this country, which is a country which has for long not been attracted by artists. This country for many decades, was a country where the Protestant religion, you know, which was that of the pioneers, the priests were thinking that art was the epitome of the Europe they wanted to flee. You know, when the pioneers created the United States, they left Europe for good reasons, for politically correct reasons, because of European monarchies and because of the Catholic Church, which had art for the princes, art for the priests, but no art for the people. So for democratic reasons, those pioneers thought that art should be for the people. And it took many... In one of my books, I showed that it's at the end of the 19th century, thanks to the creation of a new social class that would be later called the robber barons, that the creation of this new social class will really admit artists in the society and admit art and collect art from Europe. And then, in turn, the American artist is going to emerge, but not before, you know, he's not going to become this important citizen before WPA, before the 1930s.
Before the 1930s,
when Roosevelt supported
and encouraged art. But I found this interesting because Rothko's timing was great. I mean, he hit New York City at a time when New York was exploding, becoming a great center for modern contemporary art. But you write in here, you quoted William Glackens, who was a realist painter, right?
Yeah.
That the United States had not had time for art. In other words, it was a young, busy country. The pioneers were setting out on their journeys, and there wasn't really time for art. And you say here, Marcus R., or who became Mark Rothko, set out on his path in 1923. Several generations of American artists had already complained about the lack of enlightenment in their country, whose culture had long been dominated by pioneers and businessmen. Throughout the colonial period, the artist's work was regarded as no more than any other useful trade, like that of a carpenter, tailor, or shoemaker, not as one of the most noble arts in the world. The purpose of artists was to document reality, with their talents being used simply to immortalize a scene, a face, a place. And I found that very interesting. And then, of course, we have to jump ahead here to the 1930s and the opening of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, the Armory Show. All of that was going on just as Rothko was getting interested in being an artist, right?
Completely. 1921 is a very important date because it's both the Depression, the Great Depression, which will produce the WPA period of Roosevelt, and also the creation of MoMA. The creation of MoMA is essential.
That would be 1929.
Creation of MoMA.
Right,
yeah,
right.
1929. So creation of MoMA is done by three women, three ladies. They are Republican, but they have a taste for modernism. And they go and pick up the youngest, most brilliant fellow, the student of Paul Sachs at Harvard. He's called Alfred Barr. He's 27 years old. And this brilliant scholar has already, in 1925, done his grand tour of Europe, visiting the Netherlands, visiting Russia, visiting Germany, visiting France, and picking up the best flowers of avant-garde modernism that could exist through the Stil, through the Futurists, through the Bauhaus. And he started trying to plant those seeds in the United States. But he did not know at the time that a few years later, with the fascist, political movements, decimate those modernist avant-garde. I mean, you know, with Hitler closing the Bauhaus in 1933, with Hitler doing the Entartete Kunst show in Munich 1937, with Mussolini, those would, destroy those flowers of modernism and would throw the people to the shores of the United States. So there was a coincidence which is fascinating. Therefore, we should never talk about art if it's not in terms of history, politics, right, and cross-cultural history.
I didn't want to leave out Leo and Gertrude Stein.
Oh, yes.
And for a Baltimore reference, the Cohn sisters. We jumped ahead here a little bit, but Matisse, Cézanne, all of that, Americans taking interest in this new avant-garde, right?
Okay, so we have to go back a few years.
Just a few years for that.
1900 is the date where the Universal Exhibition in Paris brings to Paris both Edouard Steichen from Minneapolis, Pablo Picasso from Malaga, the Steins from Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore before they were in Oakland, California, mm-hmm. And they discover, the Matisse, Picasso, and Cézanne. The Steins are creating in Paris a salon, I say an unofficial American Academy in Paris, because they're going to collect the best possible paintings of the time that the French are not collecting then. They collect Picasso, Matisse and Cézanne. And then they invite young American students to have dinner with these artists, which is something you don't do in France. You know, those steins were called by a French poet billionaires in sandals. This poet could not believe that they would be so rich and so poorly dressed. And there was a very interesting combination of their attitude, their behavior, their welcoming to students, something that would never happen in France. So the Steins were immense collectors. And then Gertrude was friendly with Etta Cohn, the Cohn sisters from Baltimore, who in turn became friendly with Matisse and Cézanne and Picasso. So one thing that the Stein Salon allowed is this fusion, this hybridization, these encounters. And this is essential in order to produce new art. For example, Picasso was living in the Bateau-Lavoir in Montmartre, in a very poor neighborhood. He would decide to do the portrait of Gertrude Stein and shuttle from Montmartre to Montparnasse. It is at Gertrude Stein that he saw the portrait of Madame Cézanne by Cézanne, and it's mimicking Cézanne that he will do this portrait of Gertrude Stein this way, with like an African mask. Mm-hmm. At a time where Picasso was experimenting with Iberic art, African art, you know, classical art with Ingres, this is an extraordinary period. Yesterday I walked through the Baltimore Museum of Art. You cannot imagine how much I love this museum. I even did a program on the French NPR about this museum.
About the Cohn collection specifically?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, listen, I mean, the round room with the two nudes. I mean, it's stunning. It's totally stunning. And you know, Baltimore means a lot to the Rothko family as well. Dan, may I tell you that? You know, Kate Rothko was 17 when her father passed away, and her brother Christopher was 6. Kate became a student at Johns Hopkins, medical student, and she's a medical doctor now in New York. And her brother came later to live with her and went to Park School. So the city of Baltimore has many memories of the Rothko children. And so I want to...
Thank you for mentioning that, Annie Cohn-Salal. Annie Cohn-Salal's book is Mark Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. It's published by Yale University Press, part of its Jewish Lives series. I was going to ask you another question, but I see we're up against another break here, so we'll take another break and come back and talk some more. Again, the focus of this hour, Mark Rothko, because of Annie Cohn-Salal's new book. If you've had a Rothko experience you'd like to share with us, been in the presence of a Rothko painting, and would like to talk about that, 410-662-8780. Also, if you have a question about the life of this artist, this is a good time to give us a ring. Our email address is midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday, a conversation with Annie Cohn-Salal, French scholar, cultural historian, biographer of Sartre, now of the painter Mark Rothko. Her new book is Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel, part of the Yale University Press's series, a Jewish Lives series. And you note in here this metamorphosis of Mark Rothko and also the pace that he set. You said that at a pace unprecedented in art history, his painting shifted from figurative to mythological in 1940, then surrealist in 1944, multiform in 1946, and ultimately colorist abstract that we know now, that's the most familiar to people, in 1949. And before the break, you mentioned the Matisse nudes, right, that you said you saw in the Baltimore Museum of Art. Mm-hmm. So nudes, yeah, you can point to it and say, yeah, well, that's a nude, right, even though it's Matisse's style. When did Rothko leave behind anything that you could consider figurative, meaning you could look at it and say, well, that's a cat, to what we see today?
He went, and that's why the book tries to approach him differently. 1940, he went into a period of doubt, a period of silence as a painter, where he became a writer. For a whole year, he put his brush aside and decided to write a book. In this book, he put together the engine of his art, which is going to become the core of his project. This book is called The Artist's Reality, and it has just been published recently. It was written in 1940, but it was published in 2005 only. Who did it? His son, Christopher, who found the manuscript, transcribed it, and published it. So it is extremely interesting to understand what this painter did at the time. It was a time where the Nazi invaded all of Europe, so it's not by accident that it was 1940. And in this book, Rothko revisits art history since the Greeks and the Egyptians, since antiquity. And he's, first of all, he's asking himself, what is art? What is an artist? When were the golden ages of art history? Who were the men who... So, and he connects more to the old masters than to his contemporaries. It's essential. You know, the one with whom he connects the most is Rembrandt. He loves Rembrandt because Rembrandt, at the last period of his life, did not paint what the market was expecting from him, but experimented. You know, when you see The Jewish Bride by Rembrandt, it's a commission. He should be painting, you know, the two people, but he's not interested in that. He's interested only in the sleeve of the man. It's a yellow sleeve, which becomes a sculpture. It's crazy, but it's genius. And Rothko said, art history, the history of men who, for the most part, favored hunger over compliance. So what he found by revisiting art history is that the artist is someone who is stubborn, who is a rebel, who manages to put his ideas together and does not comply. And by finding that, he's going to follow this project all his life long. And the more he's going to get older, the more he's going to experiment and to look like Rembrandt. Actually, I have been commissioned a show, a Rembrandt Rothko show at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam.
I appreciate your explanation, but you must understand for many people how difficult it is to see those two things side by side.
Okay. So let me tell you, there are artists who are very successful today. I can quote a lot of them. So what do? They just paint the way the gallerist wants them to paint in order to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly interesting. They want to become richer and richer, but it's not very, you know, interesting intellectually or creatively. You know, somebody who is going to comply to the market is somebody who's kind of weak and who's only interested in making money. In fact, Rothko is interested in the truth, in reaching out to the public, in making the public more aware of what society is all about. Mark Rothko teaches us much more than a simple matter of colors or of palette. Mark Rothko teaches us that when you are an immigrant, when you face the ethos of exclusion, you have tools in your hands because you know more cultures than the others. You know more languages than the others. Well, what did Rothko do with these tools? He turned them into assets. He created this new institution together with Dominique Dominil, which is meant to let more and more people for free access his art and come out of them, out of this viewing, as empowered.
That's a reference to the Rothko Chapel in Texas.
In Houston, Texas, yes.
Would you say Rothko was an angry man?
No, I won't say he was an angry man. I would say he was clear in his head. You know, he did not want to comply to institutional power. I think artists are whistleblowers. When I see today, Dan, the crowds which were attending his show in The Hague, when I see the crowd... Look, there's an extraordinary place also in the U.S., which is the Phillips Museum. You know, Duncan Phillips opened his museum had the same idea. Duncan Phillips said, my house should be open to everybody.
Ellen in Baltimore is calling us to talk about the Phillips. So, Ellen, welcome to the show with Ani Cohen-Salal.
Yeah, hi, Dan.
Hello, Ellen. Hi.
What? I just wanted to recommend everybody go, you know, who, if you're in D.C., to go to the Phillips. There's just a room with I think it's three. Three or four Rothko paintings and a bench, and you can just sit in there. And I don't know if it's for everybody, but it's a really wonderful experience just to sit there and look at one of these paintings.
I agree with you. I was there last week. It's extraordinary. And, you know, not only that, but the curator and the director have created other rooms which are, you know, responding to Rothko. I don't know if you went to the wax room by Wolfgang Leib. Have you been?
So is she still there? I don't know if she's still there.
Gone.
Sometimes we just take the comment and move on because there's other callers. Danny in Waverly, for instance. Go right ahead with your story, Danny. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to remark upon seeing a Rothko at the Art Institute in Chicago.
1954.
Yes. I really didn't know the reputation for the impact these works could have. I was just sort of seeing it out of the blue. I stood in front of this large canvas. It had maybe orange, some black, and red, and it felt as if it was pulsing. I had a physical reaction. My body started to shake a bit, and I sweated. And then emotionally, I sort of spontaneously started to cry, which is not really like me. And this was simply by gazing at this thing 4 feet in front of me. It was really extraordinary. I've never quite had an experience like that with something visual in front of me.
Oh, this is fantastic, Danny, what you're telling us. That's exactly what Rothko meant. He said, I want the people to weep in front of my painting and have the same emotion as the one I had. It's remarkable what you're telling us, Life. Thank you so much.
I've read stories of people weeping at a Rothko. I appreciate hearing someone call in to tell us that story. John in Highlandtown, let's take another call on Mark Rothko. Hi, John.
Morning, Mark.
Dan Roderick's here.
Dan. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I called the wrong show. No, Mark Rothko, I discovered him in the late 90s. It's about the time they opened the new wing at the BMA, and I also saw an exhibit of his work in New York. I'm not sure which museum.
Whitney.
The Whitney, exactly. Well, that it's such... There's such large pieces of work, and I noticed while I'm there, people were standing 10 or 15 feet away from it, and I felt like I needed to be right in front of it, and I would walk, and I felt like I was being consumed by the painting. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I realized was that he put layers and layers of paint, mm-hmm. and so I would go to the side of the painting mm-hmm. and look at it and just look at the textures. Mm-hmm. And so for me, a Rothko got me looking at paintings more like sculptures. Huh. That they were three-dimensional, not just two-dimensional.
Oh, that's beautiful what you're saying. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, he's also a mentor to all the new, you know, artists who work with light, you know. And you're absolutely right. It's three-dimensional. You're completely right. And that's what also got him close to Rembrandt, you know, who 3 centuries before him was already doing sculptures with paint.
I wanted you to finish this thought about his connection to Rembrandt and art history and the transition fully from figurative into this abstract that we know now.
Yes, so yes, yes.
I know we're short of time. I know it takes a while to explain that, but this was around 1949 for good, right?
Yeah, so between 1940 and 1950, Mark Rothko goes into transformation, aesthetic transformation, which gave actually, there was a wonderful show called The Decisive Decade, which traveled all through the United States 2 years ago. And so, as you said, so Rothko gets influenced by different people. One of them is Clifford Steele on the West Coast. He's shuttling between models.
He's an American painter from North Dakota, right?
Totally, totally. Yeah. And so Rothko shuttles from West Coast to East Coast, from East Coast to Europe. And, you know, and with his constantly in tension, constantly in search, constantly in quest. And I think that the only way to be at any age, but he is such... He's in such a quest because he's an immigrant, you know, because he's not at ease with his 2 feet in the two same shoes. He is always. And that brings the genius of the guy. So the last thing he sees is at MoMA, a new acquisition by Alfred Barr, 1949, which is a piece by Matisse, painted in 1911. Matisse, somebody you know very well in Baltimore. 1911, the Red Studio, which is a flat red painting, which is an artist studio with works of art unfinished, like, you know, like puppets, like sculptures and paintings. And at the center, there's a void, which is the place where the artist should stand. So Roscoe is mesmerized by this painting, stays in front of it every day. 3 weeks he comes. And what I feel in this painting is that you feel that if the artist comes back and finishes his works of art, they become immortal. If he does not, they go to garbage. So it gives you, it's a metaphor of the power of the artist. Mm. The artist is more powerful than a politician, than anybody else. The artist is the citizen in society, which is going to transform and show the way and be a whistleblower. And that's what I see in these crowds, you know, mesmerized by Rembrandt and Roscoe everywhere in the world.
What do you think Rothko would have thought of a painting of his selling for $87 million?
I think he would have been puzzled by it, but there are different markers of his success. Some are financial and some are emotion. So he would have been very, very satisfied to see the show in The Hague, to see the show in Seoul, to see the people going to Houston. He would have said, well, you know, there are financial markers, but there are other markers which are political, social, and that's what he wanted.
Another call.
Art as an experience.
Manzar wants to talk about his experience at the Rothko Chapel. Manzar, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you so much for your informative program and your guest, Miss Annie. As an undergraduate, when I was studying in Houston, Texas, I did visit the Rothko Chapel, and I suppose to write a paper about my experience, which at that time my English was so bad, mm-hmm. as I think it still is. But I remember that sitting there, and I did not know much about Rothko Chapel, but I mean the Rothko's painting in that time. But I was really sort of almost fell asleep, the tranquility of the effect of the painting. And also, it did connect me, actually, as an immigrant, connected me to where I was coming from.
Where did you come from?
I'm from Middle East, mm-hmm. And actually inspired by Sufism. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if Roscoe was influenced by any of these wisdom tradition of the East philosophies.
That's very interesting. There is a spiritual dimension in Roscoe. You know, he was not mystical, but there was a spiritual dimension. And of course, that's exactly what you felt. Thank you so much for your call.
It sounds like something we should have on our itinerary for travels to the southwest of the United States in Houston.
I'm coming with you if you want.
The Rothko Chapel.
Here we are.
Well, this has been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I wanted to spend a little more time on the spirituality of Rothko and his paintings, but we didn't get to that. There's so much to cover here, but you can read about it in Ani Cohen-Salal's new book from Yale University Press, part of their Jewish Lives series. It's called Mark Rothko, Toward the Light in the chapel there, the reference to the Rothko Chapel that I just mentioned here. So thank you very much.
I'm good to go on tweeting with you, my dear.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. It was nice to finally meet somebody we met on Twitter. So good luck with your travels on the remainder
thank
of your,
you so
your
much.
Book tour.
Terrific.
Yeah,
terrific.
It's great to have you with us.
Okay.
And we will tweet out some more information about Ani Cohen-Salal and her book later on today. And also on our Facebook page, you can find more information about Mark Rothko, and also see some examples of his work on my Facebook page. Right now, we'll take a break for lunch, brought to us on Mondays by Rosina Gourmet. Since 1999, Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. Rosina Gourmet, located in Canton, downtown Baltimore, and Harbor East. Catering available by visiting rosinagourmet.com. Please stay tuned for the news, and then we have the second hour of Midday.